From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with former New York Times reporter Raymond Bonner. His new book, Waltzing with a Dictator, investigates U.S. support of the Marcos regime in the Philippines. Also today, I'll talk with June Carter Cash. She's one of the best-known names in country music. She's just written a memoir of her life, from her childhood performances with her mother, Maybelle Carter, to her current performances with her husband, Johnny Cash. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Believers, the new suspense film starring Martin Sheen, and our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by singer-songwriter John Hiatt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Raymond Bonner. His new book, Waltzing with a Dictator, explores America's role in maintaining the dictatorship of Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. The book is a case study of our country's support of a dictator. In it, Bonner probes the political and economic motivations of five successive U.S. administrations for maintaining friendly and generous relations with the Philippine government. The book also examines the rise of Marcos and his consolidation of power after declaring martial law in 1972. Bonner reveals that the Nixon administration knew of Marcos' plans to declare martial law, but did not act to stop him. Much of Bonner's book is based on State Department cables he obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. When the State Department did not comply with requests for additional documents, Bonner filed a lawsuit that is still in progress. Bonner is a former New York Times correspondent who reported from El Salvador from 1981 to 83. His first book was titled Weakness and Deceit, U.S. Policy and El Salvador. His new book, Waltzing with a Dictator, is published by Times Books. Raymond Bonner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You chose to do a book about the Philippines before the showdown between Marcos and Aquino. Did you know that this was going to be the next hotspot?
Yes, I knew. I thought it was going to be the next hotspot, but I will not say or not begin to suggest that I ever thought it was going to end like it was and that Marcos would be ousted. I began working on the book about 2 years before the ouster of Marcos, and the reason was I thought it was going to become another Central America. This is where I had served with the New York Times, as it were. I had been a reporter down there, and the parallels were so apparent. Substitute Marcos for Somoza, one corrupt dictator for another, one alphabet insurgency, the NPA in the Philippines for the FSLN or the FMLN in El Salvador, Nicaragua. Substitute the Aquino assassination was very much like the assassination of Chamorro in Nicaragua. The church is divided in the Philippines, heavily Catholic country with a divided church between the People's Church and Liberation Theology and the very conservative hierarchy. So there were those similarities, and I thought, and in fact, those of us who were writing in Washington in those days about Central America, often we'd hear from people on the Hill or elsewhere, they'd laugh and they'd say, we'll see you in 6 months, we'll see you in Mindanao or Davao or someplace. It really did look like it was going to be the next crisis point.
You were based in El Salvador reporting for The Times, so you had firsthand experience there when you were writing your book. What about with the Philippines? Did you spend a lot of time down there doing the research?
No, I did not spend a lot of time there. I spent some time there. I mean, I was there, for example, at a very critical time, which was November and December of 1985 when Marcos called the election, and that whole process, what led to the unraveling, got started. But this is really, as I say in the author's note in this book, this is a book about Washington more than it is about Manila. This is a book more about the making of American foreign policy than it is about Philippine society, culture, mores.
The most news-making revelation in your book is that in 1972, when Marcos decided to stay in power in spite of the fact that he was finishing his second term and the Constitution only allows two terms for presidents, that the U.S. knew that he was going to declare martial law. Before we find out how you found out about this, I'd like to hear about the revelations that you found out about. How did the United States know that Marcos planned on declaring martial law?
In a phrase or in a sentence, because the CIA had done its work and done its work well. The CIA, the book opens, in fact, with this scene. And I did spend a lot of time, we'll talk about it, learning this. But the CIA had infiltrated the Marcos government, essentially. Marcos planned martial law with what he thought were 12 of his closest advisors, colonels, generals, and one civilian. They later were dubbed the Rolex 12 because Marcos gave them all gold Rolex watches. Marcos really believed that it was utmost secrecy. They were destroying drafts of documents as they prepared them and so on, safes with only few people who had knowledge of the combinations. But Marcos was betrayed by one of the 12, who gave a copy of the martial law decree to the CIA several days before Marcos even issued it.
And you also say that Marcos called President Nixon.
Yes, that comes from several sources, including Imelda Marcos has said that. I mean, Imelda Marcos said that her husband had a conversation with Nixon several days before martial law.
To say what?
According to Carlos Romulo, who was the venerable foreign minister of the Philippines and died not too long ago, but Romulo says that, in fact, there were two conversations between Marcos and Nixon, that Marcos called Nixon, told him what he was going to do, and Nixon said, I'll get back to you, and that Nixon called back a few days later and said he had no objection. Imelda only talks about one phone conversation. Basically, Marcos advised Nixon what he was going to do. And there was no protest. He heard no protest. Nixon, of course, as you know, has denied that there was ever any such conversation. He says it doesn't show up in his logs. Well, I can assure you, as we all know, those logs are rather incomplete.
So when it was leaked to the CIA and when President Nixon allegedly found out about the planning of martial law, no action was taken to prevent it.
No action was taken to stop martial law.
What do you think the American government could have done had it wanted to prevent martial law?
I think it could have made a strong and forceful statement that we will not tolerate this. After all, we have to remember, this is not just any country. This is the country where it was our former colony, where we helped establish and develop and inculcate and instill very strong democratic values. It was a functioning democracy, a two-party system, a Supreme Court, a Congress, an executive branch. And the United States should have said, Mr. Marcos, we're opposed to your declaring martial law. If you declare martial law, we're going to cut off economic aid. There's all kinds of sanctions. We're going to break economic diplomatic relations. We'll call home the ambassador. I mean, there's a scale of things the United States could have done. We didn't try anything.
That could have jeopardized our bases there and
who knows what Marcos would have done if the United States had made some protest, some inkling of objection. I mean, there wasn't a whisper, not a whimper that we were opposed to martial law, neither before or after.
Do you think that this rewrites history in any way?
It writes history accurately now, the book does, because at the time martial law was declared, the United States claimed that we were caught completely by surprise. We had no advance knowledge. That, Terry, has become the conventional history of the period. In fact, I interviewed for this book a very prominent, highly regarded, and justifiably highly regarded American scholar on the Philippines. And he told me that the United States, in his words, was caught completely flat-footed by martial law. So that has become the conventional history, and now it's set right for the first time.
How did you find out about this?
Journalistically, it was actually quite interesting. I probably spent more I can't tell you exactly how I found out about all of it, but I can tell you I spent more time chasing that story once I got the first tip and the first lead that, in fact, the CIA had infiltrated the cabinet and did know about martial law in advance.
Can you tell us what the lead was?
It came from somebody who had reason to know, who knew what the CIA knew and what the embassy in Manila knew. But I didn't know whether to believe it or not. In fact, the first chapter of the book is the last thing that I wrote after I'd written all, because until I absolutely, and that first chapter is when I talk about how the CIA found out and the relationship, the CIA informants within. I mean, among other things, I talked to some of the people who in the Philippines who were working with the CIA, and beyond that, I really don't want to say anything more, but once I got this tip and then someone else said to me, no, that I don't remember that. I don't think it happened that way. I don't recall that. And so I had to decide, is it true? Is it not? And finally, when I had enough people confirming it to me and people who I believed, I went ahead with the story.
Did Freedom of Information Act documents help support it?
Help support it, but they weren't direct on it. They weren't direct on the very issue of the infiltration. But I'll tell you what the documents show, the cables show. There were cables back and forth between Manila and Washington, in which Washington would say, it seems that it's likely Marcos is going to take some emergency measures and strong measures. What are the likelihood? And there would be cables back. And so the cables, we knew that something was pending and something was likely.
Journalist Raymond Bonner is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Waltzing with a Dictator. You're very critical of America's support of Ferdinand Marcos. What do you think made it advantageous to five United States presidents to continue support for Marcos?
It wasn't advantageous in the long run, which is a problem with American foreign policy. It tends to be short-sighted. The proof that it wasn't advantageous is the mess that the country's in today, the mess that Marcos left it in, a strong communist insurgency, a demoralized, corrupted military, and a decimated economy. But the problem is we don't think long-term. We tend to think short-term. And no, four successive, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan all gave full faith and credit to Marcos. There was even the Carter administration, which I suppose is where it becomes the most acute.
What are our major interests there?
We have the bases, obviously. We have Subic and Clark, which are the two largest military bases outside the United States. But it was not a question of either or. It wasn't either we support Marcos or we give up those bases. Marcos wanted those bases as badly as we did. See, Marcos was just smarter than we were all the time.
You say every time there was a showdown that it was the United States that blinked.
Every time. Martial law, going back to Vietnam. We wanted the Philippines to send soldiers to Vietnam so that it wouldn't look just like our war. And I talk about this to some extent in the book, how Marcos was opposed to sending soldiers to Vietnam, and then he changed his mind. Yeah, he changed his mind because he had a secret agreement with LBJ whereby we were going to pass some money under the table. Came to $39 million. Again, there was a showdown. We blinked. Martial law comes along. He says, steely-eyed, he's going to declare martial law. We blinked and let him do it. Comes to a base negotiation, comes to human rights during the Carter administration. Instead of taking a hard stand on human rights, Marcos didn't want to hear about human rights. The Carter administration blinked. Every single step along the way, when there was a showdown with Marcos, Marcos won.
The Marcos were one of the wealthiest couples, probably still are, I guess, wealthiest in the world. And I think you say that the salary that Ferdinand Marcos was getting was around $6,000?
Never more than $6,000.
And neither of them had inherited any money. What did they do to amass the fortune that they got?
It's called stealing, pure and simple. There was a joke in the Philippines in the early 1970s after martial law was declared. What's the biggest industry in the Philippines? Imelda's mining company. That's mine, that's mine, that's mine. She just went around and took companies. They forced people to sell. You say, well, take the Philippine Airlines. It was a private company. It was like TWA or United or whatever. Private airline. Imelda flew all over the world on it. One day, Marcos said to the president of Philippine Airlines, submit a bill for her travels. He was reluctant, but Marcos insisted. So the guy submitted a bill for Imelda's travels. Marcos nationalized the airline. And it was that way. You know, the Aquinos owned a lot of property and a bus company. Marcos, after declaring martial law, freezes the rates, the bus fares, so they couldn't charge any more on the bus fares. And, of course, oil prices at that time were going up, so they was going to lose money. So they had to sell. So they find a buyer, and the Marcos equivalent of the Corporation Council or SEC says, well, I don't think we'll approve the sale to that buyer. So one of Marcos's cronies buys the company. You know, you sell. Otherwise, the IRS comes around and the Justice Department comes around and the equivalent of the FBI comes around. And when they're all controlled by the dictator, you don't have any choice.
One of Imelda Marcos's big projects was the development of a cultural center in the Philippines. And the way you describe it, she sent letters to all the businesses telling them how much they'd be expected to pay to help build the center, and then she'd send someone out to collect the payment in cash. You make it sound like organized crime.
It was de rigueur. That's the way she operated. And the only thing that changed was she got more brazen. Early on, she'd asked for $25,000, then got up to $50,000. And after she declared martial law, she just demanded a 10% or 50% interest in the company.
How did you find out about that?
Oh, I talked to a lot of people. American officials knew about it. Again, off and on, our CIA people knew about it, our embassy people knew about it, our ambassadors knew about it, our political counselors knew about it. And although, as we talked earlier, I started this book before Marcos fell, obviously I finished it after he was toppled. And at that point, a lot of people were more willing to talk. And I talked to Filipinos, Filipinos who were in and around the government, Filipinos who had been in Marcos's government. For example, I found out about the $2 million campaign contribution to the Nixons, to the Nixon 1968 and 72 campaign. The Marcoses gave him $2 million. I found out about that from a former member of the Marcos cabinet.
My guest is journalist Raymond Bonner, and we're discussing his new book, Waltzing with the Dictator. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Raymond Bonner is my guest. He's a former New York Times reporter whose new book, Waltzing with the Dictator, examines how and why the United States supported Ferdinand Marcos. We were just talking about the wealth that the Marcoses amassed. They wined and dined all the American diplomats in the Philippines and those visiting the Philippines. Can you describe what some of those parties were like?
Well, they were a cross between Las Vegas and the White House state dinners. I mean, there'd be, you know, 3 and 4 wine goblets and fine china on the table, and the long table for the guest list and the guests of honor, and then the masses would be called in. I'm not the masses, but 200 or 300 people would be invited, or 400 people, and there'd be strolling violinists and people running around catering and serving drinks and the hors d'oeuvres. And then afterwards, there'd usually be 2 or 3 hours of entertainment. I mean, some of it, Imelda would have dancers and singers, and of course, she would always sing. But she did. You see, Imelda, I think, has been both underrated and overrated. I mean, I think we've overwritten and over-talked about, talked to excess, if you will, appropriately, I suppose, with Imelda Marcos about her spending and her shoes and her collection of clothes. But I think we've underestimated the role she played in keeping world leaders, and particularly American leaders and policymakers, in line. This woman met with 5 American presidents. I mean, I don't think there's very many world leaders that have met with 5 American presidents, let alone the wife of a third world leader. And as I say in the book, I think Imelda Marcos met more heads of state and logged more diplomatic miles than Henry Kissinger, Gaddafi, Castro, Mao. She went everywhere and met with all of them and danced and dined with all of them.
Well, I wonder how much dancing, dining, and elaborate entertaining really affects policy. I mean, do you think that diplomats really feel beholden to a government because they've been invited to a really lavish party?
Well, it's not that direct, and it's much more subtle than that. But go back to 69, 70, 71, 72. Go back to 72 when martial law was declared. Now, prior to that time, Imelda Marcos has already been to the White House twice under LBJ. LBJ even has a private dinner for her in the White House. She has had Nixon out to the Philippines and lavishly entertained Nixon. Ronald Reagan, as the young governor of California, has been out there. Now, it means 2 things. First of all, I think there's a mindset, well, wait a minute, can this woman really be that evil? Can she really be that bad when she's been entertained by so many American presidents and been in the company of so many American presidents? I mean, I think that's probably at work, like in 1972 when they declare martial law, why we maybe didn't, although there was good reason to see the worst. It's that, it's a subtle thing that's at work. I mean, I don't think anybody finds a direct correlation, but it's hard to be nasty to someone who has been so kind and overly kind to you. I mean, that's human nature.
You know, one of the things you do in the book is every time Imelda Marcos is in it, you're describing what she's wearing, and you use all the appropriate fashion terms, neckline descriptions, fabrics. I've never even heard of half of these words. How did you find out the words to use to describe what she was wearing?
Well, that's one of the nice things about doing a book. You learn, you get to learn about different areas and different things. I mean, mostly I learned about American foreign policy and learned about that part of the world. But going back to the charm and the skills Imelda had and how successful she was at it. There's a good anecdote, I think, that's illustrative. It involves Henry Kissinger, and of course there's a picture in the book of her dancing with Kissinger on the presidential yacht in the Philippines. Kissinger goes out to the Philippines with President Ford, and there's the usual lavish opening ceremony, and Imelda gets up, grabs the microphone, and begins to speak, and Kissinger leans to the American ambassador, William Sullivan, and he says, "I can't stand that woman." He says it too loud, and he's a bit overheard. And the next day, they go out in the presidential yacht, the Marcos's yacht, which, of course, is bigger than our president's yacht. And Imelda pulls Kissinger aside, and for a couple of hours, they go off to the stateroom and talk about only the two of them know what. And afterwards, Kissinger comes out, and he says to the American ambassador, who didn't get along with Imelda, he says, "The American ambassador, I don't understand why you can't get along," in his deep, deep voice, "why you can't get along with her. She's so charming." I mean, Kissinger is no fool, and yet he was charmed by her, too. Andy Young, the mayor of Atlanta, went when he was Carter's UN representative, went to the Philippines. He came back singing the praises of the Marcoses and the great things they were doing.
Let's move up to the election race between Marcos and Aquino. You said that the Reagan administration didn't support Aquino till it was the absolute last minute. What was, do you think, the final straw? The final, wrong cliche, the last straw.
Well, what it was that it was the last straw and it was all over. And finally, the Reagan White House realized this. There was no alternative. Marcos was going to be toppled and we'd better get in on the right side finally. But it's important, I think, Terry, in talking about the final days, months, even 6 months maybe, to make a distinction. And I do this in the book, and I think it's very important. You cannot talk about the Reagan administration or the Washington policy or the American policy. There was really a split, and again, I think this is setting history straight because it was, I wouldn't say misreported, but just not reported. There were really two tracks, the White House and the State Department. Now, there wasn't the conflict in the direct confrontation that we had over the Iran initiative, but the White House was sticking with Marcos. Make no mistake about it. Remember, a week before the election, Chief of Staff Donald Regan's on This Week with David Brinkley asked, "Well, what if it's a fraudulent election? What if it's grossly fraudulent?" And Regan says, "Well, there's a lot of fraudulently elected governments around the world, and we do business with them." A bit cavalier, but also quite, sadly, quite accurate about American policy. No question we were with Marcos. The State Department, on the other hand, is starting about a year earlier, is trying to put some distance between Washington and the Marcos government, trying to put pressure on Marcos to reform. And once Aquino gets in the race, once there's going to be a contest, the State Department is really tilting towards, I mean, really stretching the limits of neutrality that the State Department is supposed to have and is backing Aquino. So you really have the Reagan camp still with Marcos. Remember when Reagan makes that statement on Tuesday night press conference, there's fraud on both sides? It was the statement that caused the uproar around the world. That was reported as a flub and a mistake. It wasn't a flub. That reflected the policy of the Reagan White House, which was to stick with Marcos. Finally, I mean, it wasn't until 11:59, 59, 59, 50. I mean, the finger was on the buzzer before President Reagan of the United States decided that he was no longer going to support Ferdinand Marcos, whereas the White House had pulled away, you know, at least several days earlier. I mean, the State Department had pulled away several days earlier.
You end your book by saying that we should stop supporting dictators not because of any moral imperative, but because of cold, hard, real politics.
Sure, the proof before. How about the Shah before? Well, people say, well, we withdrew our support for the Shah and we got Khomeini. It's the wrong lesson. We supported the Shah for so long that we guaranteed we were going to get somebody who was going to be virulently anti-American. Look at the lessons of Marcos. We supported Marcos for 20 years, and what do we have to show for it? When Marcos declared martial law in 1972, there were between 385 and 1,000 members of the Communist Party, New People's Army, in the Philippines. Think about that. Less than 1,000. And those numbers, by the way, come from classified, highly classified U.S. government documents. They're not made-up numbers. Today, there's a serious communist insurgency in the Philippines. What, 20,000 well-armed, well-trained, well-equipped, well-motivated, hardcore members of the New People's Army and a threat to the government. during Marcos and because of Marcos, the communists grew stronger. So rather than avoid what we say we're trying to avoid, we guarantee the very result we're trying to avoid. The military. The military, Philippine military was one of the most democratic, one of the most professional in the third world. It was a military to be proud of. It was created in the image of General Douglas MacArthur. Marcos corrupted it, and it's demoralized.
What do you think the chances are that Cory Aquino can run a democratic government in the Philippines? And I'm thinking back to some of the coverage you have of reporters' reactions when they first started interviewing Cory Aquino, and you quote several reporters as saying they'd never spoken to someone who seemed as ill-prepared as she was and who was as scattered in her thoughts.
I have to tell you, I was there in December 1985 when a lot of these interviews were going on and when she was beginning her campaign, and quite frankly, I had the same feeling. I didn't think she was prepared to run the country. She's proven me wrong by her actions. She's done very well. I mean, she took on Marcos and she slayed the giant. She took on the Reagan administration. She stood up to them and she stood up to Enrile. The question is, though, can she govern and can she... will she be successful? And I think the answer is something that I write in the book and I'd read from it. And that is a secret report that was done by the Central Intelligence Agency in which the CIA said the major problems in the Philippines are land hunger in the countryside, unemployment in the cities, and grinding poverty for the overwhelming majority of the people. CIA went on to say that unless something was done to address these problems, there's going to be greater instability and they would be exploited by the leftists. Terry, that was written in 1965, and it could be written in June 1987. So she has to address those issues, or she's going to be faced with a real insurgency from the communists.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to spend that time talking about press coverage of the Philippines, which you also address in your book. You even quote Life magazine as writing about Imelda Marcos: "Not since the days of Jackie Kennedy has a first lady moved into her role with the verve and style of Imelda Marcos." And the title of this piece was "The Philippines' Fabulous First Lady." Do you think that the press coverage of the Marcoses missed the boat early on?
Yes, very definitely. I mean, it wasn't just Life magazine. I mean, Time magazine wrote a cover story on Marcos in which, they described Imelda. Time magazine, these are words I would never use, is a proudly packaged 36-23-35. Time magazine. The New York Times wrote three man in the newses on Marcos. The glowing reports about him. No journalist ever probed to find out that his war record was fraudulent until 1983. Yeah, I mean, everybody accepted Marcos and was willing, thought he was a great man. There was some good reporting also. I mean, the problem really wasn't with the reporting so much as it was in Washington with the policymakers. In 1978, there were five front-page stories in the New York Times by Fox Butterfield about the corruption in the Marcos government. 1978, the fraud in the election, and the Carter administration simply didn't respond, didn't use that as a basis for taking a strong stand with Marcos.
We only have a few seconds left. You got your start as a journalist on regular reporting, beat reporting from El Salvador for the New York Times. Now you're writing books and you're doing these lengthy investigative stories. Did you have to relearn how to write to go from deadline writing to book writing? And I've only left you a couple of seconds to answer this.
No, I mean, it's a different kind of writing. I miss the daily journalism. I miss the opportunity to have an outlet when you've got stories that you can break. I suppose Harrison Salisbury's the model. He was a great journalist and he also wrote a lot of books.
Raymond Bonner, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been journalist Raymond Bonner. His new book, Waltzing with a Dictator, examines how and why the U.S. government supported Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. Waltzing with a Dictator is published by Times Books. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with harmonica player Larry Adler. He's performed with Fred Astaire, George Gershwin, and Jack Benny, among others. He moved to England after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. So I hope you can join us. Here's a quick sample of Larry Adler's playing. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Beep, beep, beep. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, June Carter Cash talks about her life in country music. She was part of the singing Carter family, and these days performs with her husband, singer Johnny Cash. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by John Hiatt. He's a singer-songwriter who's played with Ry Cooder, Nick Lowe, and Eric Clapton. Film critic Stephen Schiff gives his thoughts on the new suspense film, The Believers, about a voodoo-like cult. And we'll get today's news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker is back. He has a review of a new album by singer-songwriter John Hiatt. It's called Bring the Family.
I got something to say, little girl. You might not like my style, but we've been hanging around this town just a little too long while. You say you're gonna get your act together, gonna take it out on the road. Well, if I don't get out of here pretty soon,
John Hiatt sings about ruined love affairs, loneliness, and the joys of loud music. To hear him and his smart, nervy songs, you'd think he was an up-and-coming rock star. But his raspy voice and the jagged edge of cynicism in his lyrics betray him. Now in his mid-30s, Hiatt has bounced around from one record label to another, picking up rave reviews from us useless critics, and watching every good song he records fade into obscurity. The closest he's come to a hit was last year, when country singer Roseanne Cash recorded his sweet love song, She Loves the Jerk. Hiatt's new album, Bring the Family, probably won't put him in the same league as Michael Jackson or Phil Collins, but when you get right down to it, who, except for maybe John Hiatt, cares? The point is that Bring the Family is a strong record, one that is honest about Hiatt's age, his failures, and his achievements. It's also about his sense of humor, which is always deadpan and frequently close to the bone. One of the best songs on Bring the Family is one that's about family, about the way the sins of the father are visited upon the son. This song is called Your Dad Did.
When the sun comes up and you stare your cup of coffee up right through the kitchen floor, when you feel like hell, so you might as well get out and sell your smart ass door to door. And Mrs. swells her to watch some jerk pick up the perks you were in line to get. And the guy that hired you just got fired and your job's expired, that just ain't told you yet. So you go and buy a brand new set of wings just to show your family just how great you feel. Just like your dad did. And you're a chip off of the old block. Why does it come as such a shock that ever rode off a wet sheet rock? Your dad
long now, supper's on and thrill is gone, but something's taking place. Yeah, the food is cold and your wife feels old, but all hands fold as the two-year-old says grace. She says, help the starving children to get well. But let my brother's hamster burn in hell. You love your wife and kids just like your dad did. Just like your dad did.
That was John Hiatt and a song called Your Dad Did. And I've never heard a rock song end with words like, you love your wife and kids just like your dad did. Isn't rock and roll supposed to be youth music? The novelist Martin Amis once remarked that at this point, a truly shocking book about Elvis Presley would reveal that he only drank milk and did volunteer work with orphans. In this sense, John Hiatt's Your Dad Did is a shocking song. Its maturity and generosity, placed in the center of a rough rock melody, are startling. The rock fans among you may have recognized the indelible style of Ry Cooder on lead guitar on that song. Cooder has come back with some terse, passionate playing on this new Hiatt album after a few years spent scoring movies. And Hiatt's rhythm section is also worth mentioning. The English singer and producer Nick Lowe on bass, and Jim Keltner, who once upon a time played drums for Eric Clapton and Delaney and Bonnie. Anyone out there remember Delaney and Bonnie? Let's hope a few years from now, radio rock critics aren't saying, anyone out there remember John Hiatt? For the past few years, sick of knocking his head against the monolith that is the rock and roll industry, Hiatt has been down in Tennessee, hanging out with country music and rhythm and blues songwriters in Nashville and Memphis. There's even a song about this on the new album called Memphis in the Meantime, one line of which goes, I don't think Ronnie Millsap's gonna ever record this song. In a smarter world, country music star Ronnie Millsap would immediately record that song. But instead, it's a world in which, as Hiatt says in the song I just played, you act like a kid just like your dad did. This album could have been called John Hiatt Grows Up.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
There's a lipstick sunset smeared across the August sky. There's a bittersweet perfume hanging in the field.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is June Carter Cash. She travels and performs with her husband, country music star Johnny Cash, but she got her start in show business long before she met him. She was born into what many consider the first family of country music. Her mother was Maybelle Carter of the original Carter family. After that group broke up, Mabel Carter formed a new group with her daughters Helen, Anita, and June. Here's a recording of Mother Mabel and the Carter sisters singing June's best-known song, Ring of Fire, later made famous by Johnny Cash.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
June Carter Cash has written a memoir about her life in country music, her marriages, raising a family, and acting in theater and television. It's called From the Heart. I asked her about the beginning of her career.
I was about 10 years old. About 10, I think. And I really didn't know if I was going to be able to perform or not. I had two sisters who could perform, and when you're standing there and you're used to just running and catching light bugs and June bugs and riding the motorcycle behind your daddy and being a tomboy, you don't know if you can sing or not.
Did you want to perform?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't think I could. But then Mother said, you know, you're going to sing, or at least I guess you are, and you're also going to learn to play that auto harp and that mandolin and that guitar and whatever. So within about a week's time, I learned to sing. I had to. But believe me, Terry, I was up and down that scale because I really didn't know where I was going to begin with.
Sounds like you didn't have a lot of confidence in your singing.
I really didn't, but I had a lot of guts. I really didn't mind trying anything, and I think that's one reason in the beginning that I used to do comedy in the beginning. I just did it because I didn't think I could sing as good as my sisters.
What were the best shows, your favorite shows to do?
Well, I've had a lot of different shows in my life. The Days with the Carter Family, that was a wonderful kind of thing. I can remember doing shows from the days in the old coal fields where there was no electricity at all, and they put the lamps on the front of the stage. I went from that to having our first public address system, doing the little concerts around in schoolhouses and then in larger auditoriums when the Carter Family was around.
When you were young, were you aware of how important your mother was in country music?
I really had no idea. I honest to goodness thought everybody alive had a sweet little blue-eyed mother that picked the wildwood flower on the guitar. But Terry, the one thing that reminded me when my mother did pass away was the television cameras that came from all of the major networks, and then I began to know. And, of course, if there's the times that you ever read history books in country music, she had a strong influence on our music. And, of course, my Uncle A.P. Carter and the songs of the Carter Family. That's kind of a basis for our country music today.
When you were a child and you were or a young girl and you were performing with your sisters and your mother, were you allowed to keep any of the money that you'd get for performances?
The monies that we made, I remember our first radio show paid each of us girls in the 1939 or 1940, it paid each of us $15 a week, which that was $45 a week for the three of us. And of course, my mother was making what they considered big money in radio at that time. It's when she broke away from the old original Carter Family, and they didn't work together anymore, and we were no longer a part of them, when it became the Carter Sisters and Mother Maybelle. And I was about 14. She gave me a cut of everything we made, and my sisters as well.
It's interesting to me that you grew up into a life of country music, and you were singing it and playing it when you were very young. But when you came of age, you left that life for a while to go to Manhattan. What made you want to try out a different life for a while, to try to get into movies, for instance, to move up north, to move to the city?
Well, you see, I had married the top country music entertainer, a man named Carl Smith. He was our number one country artist for 3 years during the time we were married. And we had a little girl, and my marriage had gone crazy, and I was heartbroken. And I just took off and brought Carl in, and I had what I thought was a tiny little apartment. I had 5 rooms, and I lived at 20 East 67th between Madison and 5th, and I thought, this is not big enough to cook any kind of a breakfast in. How am I going to get the gravy and the biscuits made here? It's not big enough. I thought I was cooking in a closet.
Did you experience culture shock in Manhattan?
Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you, I'm a little mountain girl. I mean, even though I've been in radio and been lots of places, I've traveled, but I had myself quite a shock. I'd been here before. My mother and sisters and I had performed 4 times on the Kate Smith Evening Hour when she had her first hour-long show. And we were performing live with Kate in front of about 5,000 people. But I was a very young girl at that time, and I didn't let too much in New York get on me. But when I came here to go to school, listen, I had to learn the hard way.
Why did you leave Manhattan?
Well, In country music, I was established. I could make a lot of money. I could make a whole lot more money in country music than I could in this area, but I was working the fair seasons. I was going out to California and doing some acting because I'd done things like Gunsmoke and some series that I'd worked in, and I was working some with Tennessee Ernie Ford on television. So I went back to Nashville and the Grand Ole Opry because of some long extended tours that I had that was paying me quite a bit of money. Then, to make a long story short, I ended up with Johnny Cash came into my life, and I ended up being Mrs. Johnny Cash, and I'll never regret that.
When you realized that you were both in love, were you ever afraid to marry him because of his chemical dependency?
Oh, of course, of course. I only decided 6 months before we were married. I made my mind up, okay, if you feel that you can stay straight, I will marry you. If that's what you really think that you can do. And he stayed straight for 6 months. I handed in my resignation to the Grand Ole Opry, and I thought, if you die, I will stand near you while you die. If you live, I will live with you, and I will be with you. I will help you whatever you do. But it was a total commitment that I made at that point. And he never let me down.
In your new book, you've written about women friends and women in your family who were abused by their husbands or who had to put up with drug and alcohol problems that their husbands had. How much power do you think a loving wife has to change her husband if he has a problem either with violence or with drugs or alcohol?
Well, you have much more power if you're a praying woman than you could believe. I prayed continually, and I lifted up all my problems to God. If you have a person who is a chemically dependent person in your family, child or husband, whatever the situation would be, if you pray hard believing that God can help you and you just lift that up, I am living proof that it can work.
You wrote the song Ring of Fire, which Johnny Cash recorded, had a big hit with it. Did you write that song with him in mind?
Yes, I did. You know, he didn't even know, but I think I'd come to grips with the fact that I was in love with this man. He was still at that time with his wife. I was still married at the time. I think that's what the song was about, because, I mean, I couldn't tell anybody. How could I tell anybody? Because it was like a ring of fire.
When you gave the song to Johnny Cash to record, did he know that it was about him?
I don't know. My sister recorded it first, Anita, and it was more like the Carter family might have done it, because we were primarily more folk music. And so then Anita and Helen and Mother and I sung it with John, and we put the trumpets on it, and it became a big, big song. It's been recorded over 100 times.
June Carter Cash, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
June Carter Cash has written a book about her life called From the Heart. She spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following the kidnapping of Charles Glass in Lebanon, the latest American taken hostage. Also, more reported connections between retired General Richard Secord of the Iran-Contra affair and Edwin Wilson, the former CIA man.
Any features to tell us about?
Ah, yes, indeed. Hear that noise?
Yes.
That is Meter from a PC software program that can help you write poetry.
But why would anyone want to write poetry that way?
Aha. For the answer to that question, you'll have to tune in later on All Things Considered.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up from National Public Radio on All Things Considered. The new film, The Believers, is director John Schlesinger's first venture into the supernatural. It's about a religious cult that performs human sacrifices. Our movie critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The Believers is a howling dog of a movie, an unrelentingly noisy creature that sinks its teeth into your calf and won't let go. Most of the time, it feels sort of like this.
No! Chris! 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 Chris!
Chris! Oh! Little Chris is Martin Sheen's boy, and he's in grave danger. But then, so is Martin, and so are you, and so is everybody in New York. The big problem is Santeria, which sounds like something you might pick up from an unsavory locker room, but it's actually an evil religion from Africa. No, wait, it's not always evil. Sometimes the movie wants us to think that Santeria is okay. It's just that there's this really bad side of it that comes out whenever black people start playing conga drums. There's more than a shade of racism in this movie. See, the congas start pounding, and that's when this sinister-looking fellow with heavily mystical contact lenses shows up. And then people start finding severed cat's heads and jungle beads in Central Park. Martin Sheen bugs his eyes a lot as a police psychologist who begins to think Santeria may be responsible for a series of horrible child murders in New York. And Helen Shaver is all fear and trembling as his new girlfriend. She accidentally meets up with Mr. Contact Lens and soon comes down with a zit as big as the Ritz. I mean, this movie really knows how to make you cringe. In fact, that's all it seems to have on its tiny mind. There's no invention in it, no wit, no surprise, no real momentum. It's a film for people who like to leave the theater feeling that everyone they see on the street is probably concealing an ice pick. The director, John Schlesinger, made Sunday Bloody Sunday, and Darling, and Midnight Cowboy, and a couple of other distinguished films. But he apparently found his true calling 10 years ago with a movie named Marathon Man. In Marathon Man, Laurence Olivier played the meanest meanie imaginable. He wasn't just a Nazi. He was a Nazi dentist. We don't quite get Nazi dentists in The Believers, but how about this performance by Jimmy Smits, who usually plays the suave lawyer Cifuentes on L.A. Law?
Don't you come any closer, all right? Don't come any closer!
Nobody's screwing around with you, Tom.
Did you call us in?
Called it in, Lieutenant.
Okay. Yes, what's the problem?
Oh, Christ. You see what they did to the kid in there? Did you see?
I saw. What do you know about it?
They took my badge!
Who took your badge? Who took it? Who took it, Tom? Come on.
You don't know what they could do to me.
Tom, you did a good job on this one. Now we're on top of it. You got to let us have it. We're going to go down to the station house, and we're going to make a report.
No!
You can't stop them. You can't do anything. You don't understand anything.
Come on, Tom. We go by the book. Give me the...
Shortly after all that screaming and yelling, Mr. Contact Lens puts snakes in poor Jimmy's stomach. And you thought adult entertainment was dead.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Penn Jillette. He provides the juggling, card tricks, and verbal abuse in the magic team of Penn and Teller. Also, accordionist William Schimmel of the Tango Project visits us again, this time to share his passion for Argentinian and Kurt Weill tangos. And Ken Tucker will review the new home video release, Hey Vern. The fellow saying Hey Vern is Ernest, star of television commercials and the new film Ernest Goes to Camp. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Brutman. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.